Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tony Hopfinger of the Alaska Dispatch, and Dermot Cole, who is joining us from Juneau, also a member of the Dispatch. Dermot, you report that the state revenue forecast has become a Rorschach test. Remind us of the importance of the forecast and why the Rorschach metaphor.
Mike, the spring revenue forecast is a tradition in Alaska, sort of like the Nana Ice Classic. It just comes out just shortly before the ice breaks up. But I use that metaphor because people see in it what they want. And that is particularly true this year. The supporters of the oil tax cut a year ago say that the new revenue forecast backs up their point of view entirely. Now, and the opponents of that oil tax cut a year ago say the exact opposite thing and find evidence for their point of view in the revenue forecast. The problem is it is a series of statistics, and this, depending upon which statistics you look at, you can prove just about anything with it. My reading of it is that you can't tell much from the spring forecast because it's really just a quick update to the fall forecast.
And the importance the importance of these forecasts are that it's used for the legislature to establish how much money they have to spend in the coming year in the budget, right?
Right. It's really a budgeting tool, less so at this point because of the large amount of money that the state has in its various savings accounts. Right. But it still is a budgeting tool. And the real bad part of this whole thing is that everyone can agree that the long-term trend is downward. It is not upward. And this poses kind of a serious threat to the financial future of the state, regardless of what you think about the oil tax.
Okay. And when we're talking about revenue forecasts, we're not in New York State where we're talking about sales tax or property tax. We're talking about oil tax and most of that on the North Slope, correct?
That's exactly right. About 90% of our budget is funded by oil taxes. And this year, at this point in Alaska history, we are running a sizable deficit. And so because of the money we have in our savings accounts, that's the only thing really keeping state government afloat at the moment. The cash deficit is running about $2 billion.
And we'll have to borrow from savings to make that deficit up, correct?
Well, borrow is one word. It's actually withdrawing from savings because there's no real plan on the horizon to replace that money. So we're drawing down our savings accounts steadily and in a major way with this fiscal year.
Okay, thank you for correcting my use of the word borrowing. It was inappropriate there. Paul, Rio Tinto, the British Australian Metals Corporation, quits the Pebble Partnership and gives its stock to charity. Explain.
Mining giant Anglo American, the other partner in this operation, bailed out in September. Rio Tinto retained 19% of the project, and it started reviewing its holdings in December, including Pebble, and decided with a steady drumbeat of opposition, I think, and the EPA's threat to close it down ahead of time using the Clean Water Act's 404C provision, that they thought this would probably be a good time to bail out. They gave their shares to Alaska Community Foundation and the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Educational Fund. Senator Murkowski says that's the best way for them to have done this. It keeps interest in the state. Now we have different entities in the state holding that interest. For its part, the Pebble Partnership, Northern Dynasty, John Shively, even today, I think in the News Miner, is quoted as saying that we're driving ahead nonetheless. And I think he probably spoke the ultimate truth in all of this, which was that this thing is too valuable not to develop someday. And this someday is the question.
Okay. In the biggest Alaska journalism news in perhaps several decades, the online Alaska Dispatch buys the Anchorage Daily News for $34 million. The transfer occurs May 2nd. Tony Hopfinger will be the new editor after the merger, and I'd like to welcome Tony to our show. Tony, maybe the place to start is to tell people a little bit about the history of the Dispatch and where you got to where you are today.
Alaska Dispatch started in about mid-2008, and it was more or less something that we began at the time because there were a number of layoffs at the Daily News. McClatchy papers across the country were laying off people. And at the same time, you had some really big news going on with the corruption scandal and Ted Stevens and all of that.
The political corruption.
So we launched it as an online news only. Online news site is probably glorified. It was a news blog. It had a mix of stories and commentary. And then Palin happened about 2 weeks after we started, and suddenly there was a lot of interest.
And I assume that you and your former wife, Amanda Coyne, were doing just about all the work right in the beginning.
Yep. My day job, so to speak, was Bloomberg News and Newsweek, and she worked at APU. And then my brother was the one who actually built the site itself. And so we did that for about a year. And then Alice Rogoff, who has been up here now for more than a decade, she ended up taking a majority stake in the site. She has a background in journalism. She was at U.S. News and World Report as the CFO for many years, and also worked at the Washington Post back then with Don Graham.
She was an assistant to the publisher.
To the publisher. And her love for journalism and matched ours, and it was literally a cocktail napkin deal that we did in the mid-2009. And just started adding reporters.
Okay. And what can we expect in the way of philosophy of journalism as we proceed ahead?
Well, for those who haven't really read Dispatch, I guess, you know, our mission is statewide as far as the journalism is concerned. We want to be a watchdog. We strive to do investigative and enterprise reporting as well as provide the daily breaking news and you know, basically all the same things that the Anchorage Daily News, frankly, has done for many years, but has struggled with as there were staff cuts. You know, a lot of the DNA of Alaska Dispatch comes from the Daily News, both in the form of myself as a former reporter there, as well as a number of our staff. So, you know, for those who've been in Alaska for a long time and read the Anchorage Daily News, you probably can look back on it and see that there are things that we're trying to do with Dispatch and what we're doing with the Daily News are similar to when there was more staffing and more of a robust operation there.
How would you describe the editorial perspective that Alice Rogoff and you have developed?
You know, there really isn't any editorial perspective in the sense of if you're talking editorial page, which obviously both of you guys have done for many years. One thing you will see is that we will not have any unsigned editorials in Alaska Dispatch, Anchorage Daily News. So those will not be there. We will not endorse candidates. You know, as far as the editorial page is concerned, I think Frank Gershvig has done a very good job with that page. And I think that Scott Woodham on our side, who you know, kind of works with op-eds and members of the community, has done a good job of trying to provide a diversity of opinion. And I want that page to be as much local opinion as possible and be sort of a mirror of the community. That's Alaska's page, not for us as an institution to tell you what to think.
And then in that case, how does the Dispatch establish its identity if it doesn't through the editorial
page? Through our journalism, through our fair and objective journalism as much as possible. That can be fair and objective in anything you write, because I know that those words are tossed around quite a bit. But doing, you know, good journalism that hopefully tells both sides of a story and that strives to some kind of truth.
Okay, and when I meet the public, they ask me this question. This is what they want to know more than anything else at the present time. What's the new entity going to be called?
Really, there hasn't been any decision on that as far as the physical paper. But the two websites, those you will see merged into one. And that's going to have to happen relatively quickly. I was just on a call with that of McClatchy's team and our team, because they are on a proprietary system and we are on what's called an open source system. So we're going to have to move their content over to our site, and we'll end up with Alaska Dispatch Online as the presence.
Okay, Paul, any thoughts here?
No, I'm good.
All right, Paul, the House Rules Committee, that's in Juneau, the State House Rules Committee, introduces a minimum wage bill that would supersede the initiative scheduled to appear on the ballot later this year. The bill has created a hornet's nest of controversy in Juneau. Why?
I can't imagine. The union interest and the left interest that got the initiative together and got it on the ballot fear a repetition of something that happened in 2002 when the legislature moved against an initiative then and was pretty much forced because of decisions in the Attorney General's office to make it almost word for word verbatim of what the initiative was. The legislature did that, came back the next year and gutted it. So they took out several provisions that they deemed very important. Now they fear this now. They fear this again. It's making headway in the House
the
now.
The bill is.
The yeah. bill is. It virtually is word for word. It would take the current $7.75 minimum wage, bump it up by $2 over a couple of years, and then add in cost of living after that. It's a political hot potato.
But at this point, when you say it is rational for the proponents of the initiative to be concerned based on what happened before.
Well, it is rational. I mean, you can't argue that. It's obviously political on both sides. It was a union-driven effort in the beginning, no matter how you look at it, to drive voter turnout. And the other side now is saying, hey, here's a great way to head off voter turnout in that particular thing. Those people are not necessarily friendly to our cause. So. It's going to be a battle royal all over the next few months.
And there's quite a ways to go on this bill, right?
It's got a long ways to go.
It has to pass both houses.
Well, there are a lot of, make no mistake, union interests in this state are very powerful. You can see that in SJR 9. They're afraid to touch the constitutional revision there. And I think that
what is SJR 9?
That is a removing language from the Constitution that would the bar money going to a private and religious schools.
Oh, right.
There's a NEA is out fighting that tremendous fight. And I think the unions now wield enough power in this state, which makes politicians right and left probably a little nervous to stand up and go, hey, I'm going to vote for this.
So. Even though, 16 or 18% of our workforce is unionized?
Yeah.
Okay. Dermot, let's get back to you in Juneau. The tussle over the North Slope refinery, which the Koch brothers are closing, takes another turn as the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, Larry Hartig, interjects himself into the standards that will be applied to the cleanup of sulfalane. What are the details? And there's a lot of explaining here because we're getting into the land of parts per million.
Well, that's right, Mike. Actually, it's parts per billion, which is far beyond our ability to count. There's several related issues here. And it all comes to a point with the decision by the Flint Hills Resources to close the North Pole refinery this spring. It's a sort of major economic hit to the Fairbanks area and a real setback to the refining industry in Alaska. Sulfalane pollution is one of the key underlying economic problems the refinery is facing. Sulfalane is a solvent, and it's been used at the refinery since the mid-1980s, when the refinery was owned by the Williams Company. Now, it leaked into the groundwater over a period of many years, up to and in past the point at which Flint Hills bought the refinery in 2004. This has only been identified as a pollutant that's worth real serious consideration in the past few years, but there is an ongoing court fight about who's responsible for the cleanup, whether it's the Williams companies or Flint Hills, and that's on one front. Another front is, what is the targeted level of cleanup at which this chemical is something to be concerned about? The State Department of Environmental Conservation has set a level of 14 parts per billion, which, as the DEC says, is equivalent to 14 drops into an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Flint Hills has responded with its own research, saying 362 parts per billion, or 362 drops in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, should be the recommended cleanup level. The difference is, if it's 362 parts per billion, there will be very little action required in terms of cleaning up the groundwater.
What did Commissioner Hardig have to say here in this matter?
Right. He rejected he turned back, at least temporarily, the decision by the DEC staff backing up the 14 parts per billion. He said that the department did not give enough consideration to the work done by Flint Hills justifying the 362 parts per billion. Now, immediately, there's all sorts of political considerations that play into this related to the economic viability and the future of the refinery. If Flint Hills is to find a buyer for that property, which, you know, that's possible, someone has to decide who's going to pay and how much they will be paying to clean up the sulfalane pollution, which extends about 3 miles from the refinery. So it's pretty extensive. There are hundreds of homes that are getting drinking water right now from Flint Hills, and they all have pollution levels that are above 14 parts per billion, but far below, in many cases, the 362 parts per billion.
Dermot, we can't see each other's, but so I have to interrupt you. Let's add one thing here. The North Pole City Council weighed in. What did they have to say?
Well, the council is basically taking the position that one way to deal with this is by a water system. If there is a water system that eliminates the need to worry so much about the level of pollution in the ground because people won't be drinking it, there's a lot to be sorted out there, and really there's no mechanism in place to pay for these for that expansion, which would, you know, be tens of millions of dollars possibly. There's just one other thing I'd like to throw in, and that is that the governor has proposed a plan to subsidize Alaska refineries at a cost of perhaps up to $300 million over the next 5 years. That is related to this somewhat, and right now that industry, both in Fairbanks and statewide, is facing economic challenges, and the operators of the refineries say they're, you know, really not sure what their future is going to be.
Okay, thank you very much. Paul, headline, no-sell booze bill gets committee okay. What is a no-sell booze bill, and where are we going with this?
I don't know, as long as I don't wind up on it. That's all I'm saying. This kind of emanated from the Fairview Business Association. The Fairview community in Anchorage is highly impacted by street inebriates. Because the Fairview area is pretty much the centralized caregiving point for most of these folks, the homeless, that sort of thing. The Fairview Business Association, realizing that its businesses are highly impacted, wanted something done. They've come up with this no-sell booze bill, which would put people's name on a list where mine won't ever appear, I hope, and they won't serve them alcohol. They won't sell them alcohol. They won't serve them alcohol. The civil rights implications are so incredible in this, and the health implications as well. I don't know where it's going, to tell you the truth. I understand their frustration. This would apply also citywide.
It's a funny kind of bill to me that wouldn't it apply only to the municipality of Anchorage?
It would only apply to Anchorage, and then all of Anchorage, yeah. And it starts up in Fairview. Fairview, these people now are out trying to sell it to councils all over the city, trying to buy support for it. But to me, the civil rights implications, the Constitution.
The ACLU can hit this pitch. Is that what you're telling me?
I'm out of the park, I'm thinking, is what's going to happen. Yeah.
And
I understand their frustration.
Just picking a name somewhat at random, there's also the possibility that this list will have several Paul Jenkins on it.
I hope not.
Individuals will be forced to say, I'm not that particular person.
They better not.
We'll just use a Johnson or a Smith.
No,
I mean, Johnny Johnson is going to be on that list.
It's impossible. Aside from the technical aspects of it, trying to prove you're not the guy they're really not trying to serve booze to, just the concept.
The reputations of people.
The reputations.
That goes beyond that.
Yeah.
Since you got in, Tony, here's one more. It's a philosophical question. Using liquor stores, liquor outlets, and businesses to, in effect, enforce social policy.
I don't know. We've tried that before, haven't we? In some form or
another. It doesn't work very well.
Well, they also the driver's license, you have to show it, and you have the red stripe on your card and so forth.
Right. Yeah, no, I think there are some issues here that definitely need to be explored more before we, you know, just go right at it.
Okay. Dermot, the Air Force is ready to close the HAARP facility. What is HAARP, where is HAARP, and why does it matter?
Well, HAARP is a remnant, really, of the Ted Stevens earmark era in Congress. It's a research facility that the federal government has spent about close to $300 million on over the years. And the Air Force plans to close it this summer if research institutions and government agencies don't come up with a plan to fund it and keep it in operation. It's designed to research the ionosphere and has become the source of 1,001 conspiracy theories over the years related to mind control and weather control and, you know, dictating as to what Paul Jenkins will write on a daily basis. It consists of antennas that sort of basically beam energy into the ionosphere and changes in that layer of 60 miles so above the Earth's surface are monitored. Researchers really love it and are enthusiastic about this project and trying to keep it going. The Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks is leading an effort to try and get a coalition of groups together to provide funding to keep it operating. It'll cost several million dollars a year to run the facility, which is near Gakona off the Richardson Highway, and we'll see in the next month or so as to whether or not they succeed.
And if I guess I'm to assume here that the real effects will be on people who are in pure research or maybe some applied research that I'm not aware of. They would be the most people who would be affected by several million dollars disappearing.
Yeah, that's true. And it involves really no agency to step forward and say, yeah, I want to run that. Part of the problem, according to the people that have conducted research at HAARP, is its origin. It began with earmarks from Ted Stevens and never really went through the normal process. And that sort of cast a bad light on this over the years, you know, more so than really the conspiracy theories, which are alive and well. You look on the internet, you'll find everything is blamed on HAARP. That doesn't seem to affect the researchers too much. They don't seem to pay any attention to that discussion. But they will give up money to actually help fund this is a different question.
Okay, it's probably a fascinating dissertation for somebody on why HAARP would become the center of this conspiracy theory. Paul, Anchorage police are writing fewer tickets. Why? And does fewer tickets mean more dangerous driving?
Well, let me say at the outset that this is all very good news for those of us who see speed limits as advisory. They have managed to write half as many tickets over the past years. In 2009, they wrote 56,000. I guess last year they wrote 22,000 tickets. And you would think that would create chaos on the roadways. It has not. 2009, we had 8,270 accidents. And 2012, 8,085. So there are fewer accidents
as well. Can I ask you this? Can somebody say here, this improves my chances of running that light about 60%?
Well, that would make
running a light without a ticket.
Probably be so, not to any of our good health anyway. That's, you can sit at any intersection and see what's happening here. That's neither here nor there. The police are down from 380, I guess, in 2010 to 328 now. They've got recruits coming in. They'll be training them, getting them out on the highway. Although, it's difficult to explain why you have fewer tickets and fewer accidents. So more police means what? More tickets, more accidents? I don't know.
Okay, we'll see. Dermot, I wanted to get you back here on one thing. You covered the legislature before in the past, but this is the first time you've been down there in a few years, correct? When's the last time you were down there?
Well, it was a while ago, Mike. The first time I've actually been down to Juneau to cover the legislature as opposed to visiting was in 1978.
Okay, this was not my purpose to. I thought it would be a little while. Can you give us some perspective on What are some of the things you've noticed as that have changed down there? What stands out?
Well, what really stands out is the flow of information now is so much greater than it was before, and the ability to get information is also improved. That doesn't mean that you get access to the moments at which people make decisions, and that's always the rub with the legislature into how deals are cut and how decisions and how decisions are made. That by and large is not made out in public. So that I think is the same as ever. It's just that there's a great deal of information and misinformation that flows about now. That it was just much more limited in the old days, where everything had to be physically copied and printed. Getting beyond paper in that sense has really increased made it a flood. That's an enormous change.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're beyond our time limit. I'd like to thank Tony Hopfiger, Paul Jenkins, and Dermot Cole for joining us, and we'll be back next week with Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.